Some of you I'll never see again. The memory of your closeness is enough. When I think of what we've shared as boys and men, I know we've shared a special kind of love. I know whatever I may do, a part of you comes with me too. I know the things I've shared with you can't be replaced, just added to. And to each one of you, wherever you may be, I want to thank you for the love you gave to me. As little boys, our common bond began, growing together from the start. Was it playing with toy trucks there in the sand that I first felt your impression on my heart? Exploring fields of fantasy, of wars and heroes strong and free, conquering the city park, playing baseball after dark, and all kinds of things we didn't understand about the early training of a man. They say that opposites attract, and hearts are just like magnets that justify priority to some romantic fantasy. But likeness bears a bond that lasts, our commonness a knot tied fast. Let's celebrate the love we've shared these years. I remember so well that summer day. We worked together at a camp. The sun beat down, the heat was there to stay. And she and I were sitting in the sand. You came up softly behind me, kissed her quick, then kissed me. You showed your feelings honestly and said, who cares if others see? You knew our love was real, you weren't ashamed. I learned a lot about myself that day. A solitary boat drifts on a lake, its surface just as smooth and still as glass. Two riders in the boat sit face to face, with fishing poles held loosely in their hands. They catch no fish, but they don't care. That isn't really why they're there. The talk is warm, the beer is cold, and the feeling's strong as the lake is old. And when the conversation comes to natural rest, the easy silence speaks their friendship best. They say that opposites attract, and hearts are just like magnets that justify priority to some romantic fantasy. But likeness bears a bond that lasts, our commonness a knot tied fast. Let's celebrate the love we've shared these years and failed to name. Thank you.
That was For My Men Friends by Willie Cerdillo from the album Walls to Roses. This is J.D. Doyle, and I interviewed Willie for my September 2008 show that paid a tribute to that album. He gave me some wonderful comments on the making of that album that dealt with the conception of the project and how the ideas evolved, and some fascinating background information that comments not only on the collective process used, but on the culture of those times. Due to the time constraints of the broadcast version of that show, I was only able to use about a third of the interview, but it is far too good not to share the rest. And for completeness, as some of you may not choose to listen to the main show, I'm giving the entire interview here. I contacted Willie just prior to the 30th anniversary of the recording of the album. Tell me about the making of the album, Walls to Roses.
Well, my friend George Puljanidhi Shakar, who was part of the collective, always says that if we had known what we were doing, we would never have been able to make the recording. But because we didn't know anything, we kind of did the almost impossible. The long story is, I started going to some national conferences on men and masculinity, which were starting to take place in different places around the country. They were pro-feminist and pro-gay and lesbian conferences focusing on all sorts of issues related to sexuality, sexual identity, and the treatment of women in our culture. At the first one of these I went to, which was in Iowa, which was in 1977 in Des Moines, that was the third one of these conferences, I heard a man named Jeff Morgan singing songs. Jeff was an established country songwriter in Nashville, Tennessee. He had written hit songs for major artists, Dolly Parton and people like that, but had become very active in the burgeoning men's movement and started putting his songwriting talents to work around issues related to that. So I heard him sing and was very, very moved by it. It was the start of something that was a male version of what Holly Near was doing. And I'd been listening to Holly and some of the other women's movement singer-songwriters. And I started writing songs. I'm not sure if I had started writing songs before I heard Jeff, or I know that hearing Jeff was an important point for me. And he inspired a number of us to start writing more songs in that direction. It certainly occurred to me that there was a male voice to be heard in the culture wars around issues of sexual politics. So not too long after, I started looking for other men who were musicians who were dealing with these kinds of issues, and put together a loose collective of men from around the country, most of whom had not met each other, with the idea of getting together in one location and in a few days meeting each other, working collectively to determine a repertoire, learning and rehearsing and arranging songs and recording an album. Even before we got together, Moses Ash at Folkways Records, when I approached him about this idea, was immediately very positive and said he would distribute the recording, he'd put it out on his label. And so we went about trying to do some fundraising to get the money together to make this thing happen, both to help with transportation expenses for people who were coming from a long distance, and also to pay for the recording costs. It was just unheard of to do anything that fast. In 4 days, we did a benefit concert to help pay for the recording. We met each other for the first time. We chose the songs. We did all the rehearsing, arranging, and all the recording. It was kind of a real whirlwind, and most recording processes take much more time in the studio. So that's basically what happened. We got together in my apartment in Cambridge, Massachusetts at the time, and had an intense few days in 1978, in August of 1978.
How were the artists chosen, and how were the songs chosen?
Well, the artists were chosen, a lot of it was word of mouth. I think I put out some advertising in things like Gay Community News and The Real Paper in the Boston area. So I started to meet, and I would go to a lot of concerts and be looking, and I had my eyes open for men who were doing something that was related. I knew Fred Small already. I met some people through placing these ads. I got some phone calls. I think that's how I met George. And then George knew some other people, Kenny Arkin, Michael Husson. I met through hearing him play with Marcia Taylor. It was kind of like one person would lead to another. And I also just, when I'd hear about somebody, I would call them or write them, try to get in touch with them. Or, you know, I knew about Jeff Langley from his work with Holly Near. I figured somebody working with Holly Near would probably be pretty sympathetic to this whole idea. So I was able to get in touch with him, and he and I met in New York a couple of times. Although he didn't actually come participate in the recording sessions, he was more experienced than most of us and was very supportive and gave us a lot of knowledge behind the scenes, and did come up to the Boston area to help do some of the mixing.
And his song became the title song.
Yes. Even though he wasn't there for the actual recording sessions, his presence was very strongly felt. So those of us who did get together, got together in my apartment in Cambridge. We had circulated cassette tapes before that of possible repertoire, just so that we could hear what each other was doing, so we could have an idea of some of the possible songs. But we didn't make any decisions about the repertoire until we actually got together. And when we got together, we played the songs live for each other, and then went through endless discussions to try to hone down the repertoire that seemed like it was most powerful and that covered a range of issues. The majority of men who were part of this were gay men, and a lot of the material that they were singing and writing was reflective of that particular experience and point of view. And that was certainly consistent with the message we wanted to put out. So there's a very strong gay liberation component to the recording. But it's also, I think, important to point out that it's, you know, obviously the gay community is very, very diverse. You can't pin it down to one way of thinking or looking at the world. And the unifying factor in this particular project for the gay and the straight men was that there was a pro-feminist understanding and vision behind all of our song choices and all of what we were doing.
I've long considered this a landmark album because of the strength of the gay material on it, and the fact that it was a various artists album, which had never been done up to that point. And I always thought it was interesting that it was produced by a straight artist. And how did being straight factor into the project?
Well, that's an interesting question. You know, my relationships with different men who were part of this, you know, varied. I mean, I was getting to know and become very close with some gay men in the Boston area through working on this project in the lead up to the actual gathering of all of us from around the country. And, you know, I had been active in the men's movement for, you know, a couple of years by this time, and I was active in a men's consciousness raising group even before going to my first national men's gathering back when I was living in Indiana.
A lot of people would be surprised that there even was a men's movement.
Yes, absolutely. Yep. And still, recently I was involved in a concert in Framingham here where I live with several other men who I met through the men's movement and who attended these conferences also. And, you know, in publicizing this event that we just had, you know, I got the same reaction now that I did, you know, when we first were doing this back in the late 70s and early 80s, which was, you know, men's movement, what the hell is that? You know, isn't the whole world a men's movement? You know, there was...
Really?
So, you know, back to your original question, you know, I would say it was working with gay men in a close way and getting to become very close on personal, in my personal relationships with a number of gay men was, you know, a growth experience for me. It was a really positive experience overall. You know, and I certainly had learning to do, but it was learning in a supportive environment. And again, all of us shared a pro-feminist perspective that was a uniting perspective. You know, not to dish dirt, but, you know, there were at least was one or two guys who I didn't know before we got together, who I think had a little bit of a chip on their shoulder in terms of me helping coordinate this and not being a gay man. Maybe thought I wasn't qualified to do it or just were resentful in some way. And we worked through it enough that we could work together. And so my relationship certainly varied, you know, depending on where other people were coming from. I mean,
I can kind of see that happening. Like, how can you identify with the gay issues and know how to get this across?
But the advantage of it being, you know, the decisions, the big decisions being made were made collectively. So I was a coordinator in a logistical sense, and I certainly had a certain vision in mind for what the project could be. But I also knew that ultimately it was the collective vision that was going to be represented, and that would probably not be exactly the same vision that I had. It may be a related vision, but it wouldn't be the same. And I had to go into it being prepared to let go of it being, you know, my project, my baby. It really had to be a collective idea that was going to be expressed. And, you know, I don't have to know somebody's experience in order to be able to be part of a collective decision. You know, I certainly try to understand someone else's experience as much as I can as an outsider. I'm never going to know what it's like to be a gay man. I haven't lived that. I'm never going to know what it's going to be like to be a woman. I'll never live that. On the other hand, I have experienced through my associations with gay men some of the ugly expressions of homophobia. You know, when you hang around with a group of gay men in public places, the average gay-bashing person doesn't necessarily make a fine distinction between who's gay and who's straight. We're all gay in their minds, and I certainly experienced some ugliness in that regard. And again, George was then, remains a very close friend, although he's now living in the Washington, D.C. area, and I don't see him more than a couple of times a year. When we were both living in Cambridge, we spent a lot of time together, and George is a very brave and strong guy. And he was very clear that he never wanted to compromise on who he was in any public situation. And I remember walking with him at night through the streets of Cambridge, and there being a group of straight, seemingly straight men, you know, sort of toughish kind of guys, on a street corner that we had to go past, and him taking my hand and holding my hand as we walked by and saying, you know, I refuse to compromise on who I am for anybody, and why don't you experience this too? And, you know, so we walked past this group of men and dealt with whatever they wanted to throw at us. Not, they didn't physically attack us. But from experiences like that, I think I have gained a certain amount of empathy for what gay men were experiencing as a rather regular assault in their lives at that time.
Was that the genesis of your song "While Walking"?
Actually, it wasn't. While walking, I think what had happened. Jeff Morgan came to visit me once during this period of time. It was after "Walls to Roses" came out, but he came and visited me, and we had some kind of a gathering and song sharing. I think he maybe even led a workshop on songwriting. And then he and I stayed up late talking, and then he didn't spend the night here. He went somewhere else. And late at night, I walked him out to his car, and we kissed goodbye. Two straight men kissing in the street. It's an unusual scene. And I think some of the neighbors witnessed that, and when I walked down the street after that, there were people that would, you know, yell the usual epithets that are yelled at gay men by homophobic men. And they just assumed that I was gay. So that was the genesis of that song.
On my July show, I interviewed Elliot Pilshaw.
Oh, Elliot.
And on the show, I played his recording of "While Walking," and he really praised the sensitivity of it coming from a straight artist, and also how the song was able to capture emotions and also be political without being preachy.
Well, I appreciate his supportive comments, and I love that he recorded that because he's a wonderful singer, and wonderful person. So I'm honored that he felt that it spoke to his experience.
Did you ever record it?
I didn't. That was written after my second solo album came out. And right after that, I got involved in playing in a Latin American band that ended up being my full-time job for 10 years. So I never recorded another album of as a singer-songwriter. So there's a whole lot of songs that I've written that have not been recorded, and that's one of them.
I wonder how he got a hold of it, from a song circle or something?
Well, Elliot lived for a while in Cambridge, and we were friends, and he also was somebody who went to some of these men and masculinity conferences, which is where I first met him before he lived in Cambridge. He was performing as a duo with Lauren
Sklenberg,
and that was when I met him. So I'm pretty sure Elliot was living in Cambridge when I wrote that song, and we were friends, and we shared songs back and forth, and that was how that came about.
You can hear Willie's song, While Walking, sung by Elliot Pilshaw, on my July 2008 Queer Music Heritage Show. People may not immediately think of it, but there were also women involved in the project. Can you tell me about that?
Sure. These were women who mostly were from the Boston area. There was one woman, Ginny Bales, who lived in Connecticut, but who was friends with the women that we knew in the Boston area. There was a thriving women's music scene, and in particular, I would say there were two major groupings of women's scenes. There was a group of women who specifically identified as lesbian and were writing songs about that experience. You know, people like Jade and Sarsaparilla was a successful duo at that time. There was a group called Lilith at that time, but who were not identified necessarily outside of lesbian and some feminist circles. Then there was another group of women who, many of whom also identified as lesbian and were singing about that experience, but who had a broader identification as social activists, singer-songwriters, and musicians. And that was the group of women that I was getting to know in the Boston area when I came here. It was a wonderful band called the New Harmony Sisterhood Band, which was one of the really early women's bands. I think the New Haven Women's, what's their actual name, New Haven Women's Rock Ensemble, I think is what it was, I think predated them. But New Harmony was one of the first bands, a political singer-songwriter, pro-feminist, lesbian and straight women's bands that got recorded back in the early days. And I got to know them through a house, but I was living in a collective housing situation at the time. And as soon as I moved here and got involved with that living situation, one of my housemates, a woman, said, "You've got to meet the women from New Harmony," and introduced me to them. So Marcia Deal, who was one of the New Harmony sisters, Marcia Taylor was performing around the Boston area. I used to see her playing in coffee houses. Michael Husson, who I mentioned earlier, who was the percussionist on Walls to Roses, was accompanying her. Just introduced myself to them after one of their concerts and got to know them. I think Marcia knew Cersei Miller, invited her in. Joanna Kasdan, again, was a feminist singer-songwriter doing socially conscious songs. So it was just kind of a circle of people who had similar perspectives, and you know, we felt that the recording needed more instrumental variation than what we were offering as singer-songwriters. I mean, most of us were people who strummed the guitar and sang. It would have been, I think, a much less interesting album if we'd left it to guitar and voice. So we set about looking for other musicians that would, you know, fill out the arrangements, and we made it a priority to support women musicians in the area. That's how we got these women involved. So they weren't part of the collective process. The decision-making was made by the men. But we hired the women, we paid them, and that's how that came about.
I see Karen Kane's name on so many albums in my collection, and this was one of her first projects.
Yes. Karen was wonderful. She was great. I learned about Karen from Joanna Kasdan. She had engineered Joanna's album, so Joanna put me in touch with Karen. Karen was totally into the whole idea. It was great. She was wonderful to work with.
Tell me about your song from the album, For My Men Friends.
Well, that song, each verse speaks about a different friendship with a man who had been an important friend to me. The verse about fishing with a friend was just before I left Indiana to come to the Boston area to try to make my mark as a musician, as it were. I had this little farewell fishing trip with a friend, close friend, John, who was one of the men who I was in a men's consciousness-raising group with. And that verse came about. The verse where the man kisses me is an old high school friend who I also worked a summer job with a couple of summers. And the little scene described in that verse took place at this summer camp where we were counselors together. It was just an attempt to express my deep affection for my men friends, you know, something that particularly straight men were not expressing a whole lot. There was all the unspoken elements of closeness, but not often given voice to, at least in the culture that I grew up in. And this was an attempt to give voice and praise and thanks to the men and the friendships that I had enjoyed.
Is there a song from the album that stands out for you?
That's an interesting question. You know, certainly Gay Spirit is a wonderful anthem that Charlie Murphy wrote that I think all of us immediately responded to. You know, I would say if there's any song that stands out for me, it's probably that one. Just because it captured so well the feeling of the times, the joy involved with being gay. And, you know, Charlie, when he talked about this song, he said, you know, this is not a song only about gay men. When I talk about a gay spirit, I'm talking about something much broader that other people can participate in besides gay men. It was saying there's something positive, there's a positive energy in being gay that we can all share in. I'm not articulating it well, but he was using the word gay in that context in a very inclusive way. I guess that's the closest I can come to describing it.
I got the impression from studying his music that he maybe incorrectly got associated with being very, very gay, and that may not have been his focus.
Well, it was certainly a strong focus, but again, like a number of us there, we were interested, you know, we were concerned about social justice in a very broad sense. And while this was one particular aspect of the social fabric that we were dealing with in this recording, it wasn't our only concern. And certainly those of us with that perspective, you know, felt that there was symbiosis between, you know, different social movements, you know, that, you know, eco-justice and gay justice are not entirely separate issues. Justice is the issue. And we're not going to attain justice if we're not attaining it on all fronts. And that means sexual equality. It means equality for gay and lesbian and transgender people. It means concern for the environment. It means defeating racism. It means working for peace. All that is connected. And Charlie certainly was coming from that kind of a place. But he is a gay man, and proudly so. And, you know, that was... He certainly wrote a number of songs that were related to a gay consciousness, and so I don't know. I wouldn't say that it's unfair to call him a gay singer songwriter. He certainly is that, but his perspective is, again, wildly and widely inclusive, and he's not limited to being defined as a gay man.
Right. Certainly, after his solo album, there's nothing lyrically or content gay that he ever recorded again.
I hadn't thought about that, but that's interesting.
You know, the rumors of the big wave and all that?
Yep.
Not gay.
But inclusive in many ways, and certainly very strongly pro-feminist. You know, I think it goes back to this whole idea of of how he viewed a gay spirit. You know, I think that his perspective is broad and inclusive, and I don't know what was going through his mind. I don't want to speak for him, but he is someone who I think he was trying to weave together a whole lot of different influences, and his overall perspective was of justice for everyone, and that, you know, it certainly includes all kinds of groups of people, including his own experience, but not limited to it.
Do you remember any particular song that you really wished had fit on the album that really stood out?
Actually, I don't. But, you know, I would say that there were people who were involved in the project who I wish had a song on the album. And in particular, I really wish that Charlie King, Charlie was part of the whole project. He was there for the recording process, and yet his voice is not heard in any way except for group chorus kinds of things. You know, Charlie is one of the better singer-songwriters in the social justice movement, been out there doing it for years and years and years, is still out there doing it. He was a great songwriter then, and he continues to be. Unfortunately, none of the songs that he presented to us really seemed to address the issues as concretely as we wanted them addressed. You know, one of the things I wish was different was that there was one of his songs on the recording.
Yes, I have interviewed him, seen him several times. He's marvelous.
But I can't remember a particular song that didn't make it. I don't really remember a lot about the songs that didn't make it. We really were going for what we thought were the strongest songs of those presented, and that's why there are some people like Chris Tanner has a couple of his songs on there, and Blackberry has a couple of songs, and you know, we did talk about, do we want to limit it to one per person to make it more inclusive, or do we want to go for what we think is the strongest material? And we opted for the latter. I don't know if we were to do it again, I don't know if I would argue to do it that way. I mean, obviously you want the strongest album possible, but it's an interesting project because the process was as important as the product. And again, I think we're missing something by not having Charlie King more visible on the recording.
Tell me a little about your own music career.
Well, it's been pretty varied. You know, when I was growing up, I was basically a saxophone player. I dabbled with other instruments, the guitar in particular, but also the piano a little bit. I was interested in jazz and did that through high school. In college, I started getting interested in North American folk music. You know, got very fascinated with guitar folk styles, acoustic guitar styles. Started writing songs when I was in college and didn't perform at all in public. I would play these songs for my friends. I got kind of into the thing of having a guitar with me pretty much at all times. So wherever I was, if I had a new song, I would play it for people, whether they wanted to hear it or not. And that was sort of my, you know, honing of my craft, or at least the beginning of it. Started performing a little bit at that point. This is where Fred Small and I connected. And Fred had already done some performing, and he and I started to do some performing together where we would each do our own set, but we would do some songs together as well, both in Fort Wayne, Indiana, where I was living and teaching, and in Ann Arbor, Michigan, where Fred was in graduate school. And I started performing in part not so much because I wanted to be a performer, but because as a teacher, I was constantly asking my students to take risks, to try things that were uncomfortable for them, to make a leap. And performing was actually very uncomfortable for me at that point. I didn't consider myself a very good singer at all in particular. And yet I was interested in words and I was interested in the message of a song. And so it wouldn't do to not have a vocal part to these songs that I was writing. And started playing at little coffee houses in and around Fort Wayne. But the more I did it, the more I kind of got hooked on the idea of performing. And also I became sort of frustrated with the fact that I'd spent my entire life in school, either as a student or as a teacher, and thought I really needed to get out into the real world and try something else. So I left my teaching job in Fort Wayne and moved to Cambridge, Massachusetts, and set out to become you know, a folk musician and singer-songwriter. And that's what I was doing when we did Walls to Roses. And on the strength of Walls to Roses and my relationship that I had developed with Moses Ash at Folkways Records, I was able to both do some touring, which gave me more experience, and then record my first solo recording.
Let's take a break here. Willie released two solo albums on Folkways, Please Tip Your Waitress in 1980 and Silent Highways in 1983, and both were engineered by Karen Kane. And helping him out on those albums were many names I recognize, from the Walls to Roses project and from other releases in my collection. Some of these folks are Marcia Taylor, George Fujiniti Shakar, Debbie Lemke, who I know of from the Berkeley Women's Music Collective, Betsy Rose, Kathy Winner, Fred Small, Martha Leader, and Susan Abbott. I want to share with you a song from each album. So from Please Tip Your Waitress is Old Friend's Song, and from Silent Highways is one with a definite change of pace called Gone, Gone, Gone.
The other night I finally made that phone call and broke the silence ringing through 4 years. Though my heart was pounding heavy as I called you, your old familiar voice stole all my fears. And it's a long and rocky road that's come between us, old friend. We've each had to go it on our own. Somehow I just can't keep from feeling that you've been right there each step along the way. I'm not trying to say that I still love you. I'm not even sure I ever did. All I'm trying to say is you're part of me. I just can't pretend you don't exist. And it's a long and rocky road that's come between us, old friend. We've each had to go it on our own. Somehow I just can't keep from feeling that you've been right there each step along the way. I expected you to hang up. I'm sorry that I didn't have more trust. We both thought that we were right last time, and now the table's turned on both of us. And it's a long and rocky road that's come between us, old friend. We've each had to go it on our own. Somehow I just can't keep from feeling that you've been right there each step along.
Gone, 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 south on Highway 1. I'm riding on a tank of gas, tank of cab. craft and brew. I grabbed in Capitola as I went flying through. It's a bluegrass show on the radio, Cape Pat, San Jose. The DJ says, howdy, Dallas Dobro is my name. He says, if I've got earphones on, I'd better take them off. This signal's just a test, it'll sure sound real enough. I'm gone, 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 south on Highway 1. Six cylinders, four doors on the run. And it won't be long, keep driving on. When I reach the border, I'll catch the setting sun. Or just a drive. My appeal's so good I know I'll burst if I can fit it inside. He's playing J.D. Pro, Emmy Lou, and Ricky Skaggs. Just the spice, it feels nice. He's won by Johnny Cash. When I think he's hit his limit, just the time he finds a song about California, where the palm trees meet the pines. I'm gone, 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 south on Highway 1. Six cylinders, four doors on the road. Keep driving on. Reach the border, catch the setting sun. If I don't stop looking out the side, it'll be my last hooray. I finally stopped by some big rock and climbed down to the sea. The sign says no trespassing, I know they don't mean me. It makes me want to hoot and holler, think that I could fly. Back on top, I'd better stop before I up and try. I'm gone, 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 south on Highway 1. Six cylinders, four doors on the run. Keep driving on. Till I reach the border, catch the setting sun.
That was Old Friend's Song and Gone, Gone, Gone. And now back to Willie talking about his music career.
I worked as a singer-songwriter for several years. I also started working with two other musicians as part of a bluegrass trio, and we toured some, and I toured some as a solo artist. And this was going on for a few years when, in 1984, when early brigades of North Americans were going to Nicaragua following the Sandinista Revolution, doing support work there. Most of the early groups of North Americans that went on coffee-picking brigades, and I considered going on one of these, but for various reasons didn't, one of the reasons being I knew nothing about picking coffee. But when someone called me up and said, we're putting together a group of musicians and artists to go to Nicaragua, would you be interested? I leapt at that because that I felt like I...
Something down your street.
Something down my street, yeah. And that was another life-changing turning point for me. I'm going to Nicaragua and came back from that, and for a while was still doing my singer-songwriter thing, although at that point I was much more interested in collaborating with other musicians. Coming back from Nicaragua, we would travel, this group of musicians would get together, whatever we could get, somebody who would invite us to do a slideshow and talk about the situation in Nicaragua. And then since we were musicians, we would always sing a few songs. And after a few months of doing that, the songs just started to take over, the slides got lost, and we decided to become a band. So that became this band, the Flor de Caña, which I was part of for its 10-year existence. And that was also when I started making a transition towards being more of a saxophone player and less of a string instrument player, although I did play string instruments in that group as well. So I was studying jazz at that point and playing Latin music. And when that band broke up 10 years later, I started to make a transition into being more of a straight-ahead jazz musician, although I still play a few Latin gigs a year, and would play more, you know, if the opportunity was there. But at this point, I'd say I'm basically a jazz saxophone player who occasionally plays the guitar. And I still produce some recordings for some other musicians, and they tend to be folk musicians who hire me to do that. And I'll usually play guitar on, you know, on some of those recordings.
Well, I think you've probably touched on my next question, but what did you learn from the Walls to Roses experience?
Well, I learned, oh boy, it's a big question. I certainly learned a lot about collective work, about the need to, you know, I mentioned this before, but the need to let go of my vision in favor of a group kind of consciousness. I think I also learned not to make assumptions. You know, there was one incident that we had that is mentioned briefly in some of the liner notes, where I wanted a cello player on my song, and hired a cellist to play, a woman cellist, a professional musician in the area. I did not know her. Someone recommended her. When I spoke to her on the phone about the project, it was before the songs were chosen. And I talked about the pro-feminist viewpoint of the recording. At that point, the songs hadn't been chosen. I had no idea what the, you know, how strong the gay positive message was going to be. Well, she got into the recording studio and heard some of the songs, and it turned out that she had all kinds of problems with the gay material. She was a member of a conservative church and felt that homosexuality was wrong. She didn't tell me this until after she had recorded her part on my song. We recorded pretty much live, as opposed to the more usual technique of overdubbing, kind of recording in layers, where the cello would normally probably be recorded as a later stage in the recording process that could have been removed from the recording, because it was done on a separate track in an isolated room. So after she recorded on my part, she told me that she was very, very uncomfortable with the whole thing and didn't want to be associated with it, didn't want her name to appear on it. And in fact, she never cashed the check even. I had started a checking account. And at the time, the working title for the group before we got together and called ourselves the Walls to Roses Collective was Men Against Sexism. And I had a bank account with checks printed with Men Against Sexism on the checks, and she refused to even cash the check. So, you know, it was my assumption that in speaking about pro-feminist issues, that equality for people regardless of their sexual orientation and identity would be included in that, and that as a woman she would be sensitive to what was going on. You know, it was a wrong assumption on my part. That was one of the things I learned, was not to make those kinds of assumptions. And then on a very practical level, I just learned an enormous amount about recording.
Let me shift that question a different way. Looking back on that album from almost 30 years later,
yep,
what are your thoughts?
Well, it was a glorious time. You know, it was very intense. It was a bit trippy in many ways. You know, there wasn't a lot of sleeping going on during those 4 days we were together. You know, I love it. I mean, it was one of those great, crazy, wild things you do when you don't know any better. And I'm really glad we did it. I did a follow-up about 10 years later, which was Feeding the Flame, Men by Songs to...
Songs by Men to End AIDS.
Thank you. Thank you. I went about that one differently simply because I felt too cumbersome to try to recreate the whole thing, to try to, you know, at that point I'd done more recording, and I knew it was impossible to do what we'd done. So I did it a much simpler way, which was to simply, you know, invite a group of men to submit a song that they would record wherever they happened to be living and just send me the recording, and then I would compile it into a CD. So I guess looking back on it, I would say at least at that point, I wanted to do it in a way that felt a little more manageable, a little less crazy, a little less wild, but I have no regrets at all. In fact, I would regret if I hadn't been involved in the first one with all its craziness and wildness.
Well, I want to ask more directly about Feeding the Flame. I can't pass up this opportunity. Here was another various artists' album reaching to the heart of our community in a very special way.
Well, you know, by this time, you know, the AIDS epidemic was just in full bloom, and I felt compelled to, you know, try to do something to...
Yeah, this was 1990.
Yeah.
When it came out.
You know, I also wanted to follow up with On Walls to Roses, just from see how we had all, you know, some of us from that group had evolved, as well as including other songwriters who had emerged during the time, some, you know, many of whom attributed their start in writing these kinds of songs to Walls to Roses, which was great. So it seemed like those two things really needed to come together. So that project began with the knowledge that it was going to be a benefit for AIDS work.
And you've got a lot of my favorite folks on this album. Tom Wilson Weinberg, The Flirtations, Roman Oskin Phillips, Michael Callan.
It was wonderful. It was wonderful. There was some reimbursement for recording expenses, but not a lot. And people did it because they supported the message and they supported the AIDS work we were doing. So it was a wonderful thing. And it was great to get to know those men. And although we didn't record together in the same way, we didn't operate as collectively, we did do a concert in San Francisco to celebrate the release of the album that included a number of us from the recording. Not everyone, but a number of us.
So were some of these recorded especially for this album?
Yes. Some were, others weren't. Yes.
As opposed to them just sending tracks they already had.
Yes. And I asked people to send something that had not been released on another album. So it could have been recorded previously, but not released previously. That was the idea. There was new music for people.
Okay. Yeah, looking back on it, as I approached it, I knew many of the songs from their own releases.
Mm-hmm.
But that must have been later.
Yes, yes.
Again, this is J.D. Doyle, and you've been listening to Queer Music Heritage. I'm closing this segment with Willie Cerdillo with another very special song by him. Please tell me about your track on the album, Feeding the Flame.
Well, at this point, I was in this Latin band that I was playing in for 10 years, Flor de Caña. And, you know, that was one of those songs that just sort of happened. You know, I find that songwriting has taken two major forms for me. One is when I have a concrete idea and I set about to try to write a song that uses that idea. And I often will labor over these songs, you know, work on them very hard over a period of time and keep trying to hone it. And those usually aren't the best songs. I have other songs that kind of just spring out full-blown, and my job is basically to write it down and then learn it, sing it. And this was one of the latter. So it wasn't one that I sat down and pondered in advance and thought really hard about. It was just something that came out. And you know, I didn't try to overanalyze it and or overwork it. It was just an expression of, you know, almost stream of consciousness.
Yeah, so many artists tell me that a particular song just flowed through them.
Usually the good ones are that way. Thank you.
poisoned our dreams. But each drop of blood, each tear we shed is kindling that kicks up the flame. Sickness comes like it came before. For medicine we are in wait. But science as yet has not found a cure for the scourge of a plague called hate. And we're feeding the flame, pass it on. We are the saints, we are passion and reason. We are the ones who take to the streets, and now is the time of our season. We're feeding the flame, pass it on. Burn all night long, fire outshine the dawn. This is the road.
Outshine the dawn. This is